A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a new wardrobe and he's not being subtle about it. He bought a fluorescent orange shirt from Carhartt, then a fluorescent yellow button-up, and spent the day rotating between them like a human traffic light. His question is whether the market for this stuff is actually shifting. Why are mainstream brands like Carhartt and Fruit of the Loom releasing fluorescent colors? Is this appropriation of work gear, or is it a genuine trend? And he wants to push back on something we said yesterday. He thinks non-workwear brands embracing industrial colors is actually a good thing, because it makes durable safety-adjacent clothing available to everyone. He also wants to know which specific companies are leading this crossover, and how it connects to sustainability and fighting fast fashion.
So let's start with the obvious question. What's actually happening in the market right now? The global high-vis workwear market was valued at roughly $3.2 billion in 2023, growing at about 6.5% CAGR through the end of the decade. That's infrastructure spending and tighter safety regs. But the streetwear crossover is a separate thing entirely. It's not being driven by OSHA mandates. It's being driven by people like Daniel buying a fluorescent button-up because life is too short.
The Fruit of the Loom fluorescent green pullover is the one that got me. That's not a workwear brand. That's the Underwear and Plain Tees company. And they're selling something that looks like it belongs on a road crew.
Right. And that's the central tension here. Are we looking at a genuine democratization of durable, functional clothing? Or is this aesthetic appropriation, taking the look of workwear without the safety standards? Because there's a real distinction, ANSI/ISEA 107-20 defines three performance classes based on background material area and reflective tape placement. A fluorescent shirt from a fashion brand might be the right color, but if it doesn't have the retro-reflective tape in the right configuration, it's not actually safety gear.
So the color is just pigment. The safety is the system.
The fluorescence grabs attention in daylight. The retro-reflective tape bounces headlights back at night. You need both for Class 2 or Class 3 certification. A lot of what's hitting the fashion market now has the color but skips the tape entirely. Or it has tape in decorative patterns that don't meet the standard.
Which is fine if you're buying it to look interesting at a bar. Less fine if you're a flagger on a highway who thinks they're protected.
And that's where the confusion risk lives. But let me push back on myself here, because I said yesterday that mainstream brands releasing fluorescent colors was appropriation, and Daniel's counterargument is actually worth sitting with. His point is that normalizing these colors across everyday clothing makes safety wear more accessible to people who need it, but don't want to look like they're on a job site.
The stealth utility argument. You're wearing what looks like a regular button-up, but it's actually got reflective stripes, and when you step onto a dark road, you're visible. That's not appropriation, that's adoption. The safety function is still there.
The high-vis button-up Daniel bought is a perfect case study. It has the reflective stripes, but it's cut like a regular shirt. It passes in a coffee shop. You don't look like you wandered off a construction site. You look like someone who made an interesting fashion choice. But the function is intact.
I said yesterday that high-vis green was too engineered to ever be fully accepted as fashion. I might need to walk that back a little.
Hold.
Orange has always had an easier path. It's a warm color. It shows up in autumn collections. It reads as intentional. But green, that specific fluorescent lime, that's the one that screams safety infrastructure. And yet here we are, with Fruit of the Loom selling it as a pullover. If the mass market is comfortable buying that color from a basics brand, something has shifted.
I think the shift is partly supply chain. The same polyester and dye lots used for workwear can be diverted to fashion lines with minimal retooling. If you're already manufacturing fluorescent fabric for safety vests, adding a fashion SKU is incremental cost. The infrastructure exists.
So it's not a movement, it's a margin play.
It's both. The margin play enables the movement. And the movement is real. Post-pandemic, there's a documented shift toward durable, multi-purpose clothing. People want garments that work for commuting, outdoor activities, and casual wear without owning three separate wardrobes.
The pandemic broke the last barrier between inside clothes and outside clothes, and now we're breaking the barrier between work clothes and life clothes.
And that connects directly to the sustainability argument Daniel raised. Fast fashion produces 100 billion garments annually. 60% end up in landfills within a year. Workwear is built to a different standard. Carhartt's duck canvas jackets are famously buy-it-for-life items. Reinforced seams, heavy-duty zippers, abrasion-resistant fabrics. If mainstream brands start adopting workwear-grade durability, that shifts consumer expectations.
The problem is, a lot of what's hitting the market now is workwear aesthetics without workwear construction. The color is fluorescent, but the fabric is the same thin cotton blend they use for everything else. That's not sustainability. That's cosplay.
And that's the bifurcation we need to watch for. The real thing, ANSI-compliant, built to last, versus the fast fashion knockoff that's just the color. If consumers can't tell the difference, the whole category gets diluted.
Alright, so let's get into the brands. Daniel asked which specific companies are following this trend. To understand whether this is appropriation or adoption, we need to look at the numbers and the brand strategies.
Carhartt is the obvious starting point. Their core workwear line has always had high V options. That's not new. What's new is the blurring. Carhartt Whip, work in progress, launched in 1994 as a European streetwear arm. It's a completely separate division. They take workwear silhouettes and materials and adapt them for fashion. The WIP line doesn't dilute the core workwear. It's a different customer, different distribution, different price point.
So the guy buying a Carhartt Whip jacket for 200 euros in Berlin isn't the same guy buying a Carhartt duck coat for actual farm work in Iowa.
Right. And Carhartt has been careful about that separation. The core line still meets all the relevant safety standards. The Whip line plays with the aesthetic. But what Daniel is noticing, the fluorescent orange shirt that's coming from the core line, not WIP, that's Carhartt saying, we can sell Hy-Vee directly to consumers who aren't buying it for a job site.
Which makes sense. Carhartt has the authenticity. Nobody questions whether they're allowed to make Hy-Vees. They've been doing it for decades. The brand permission is baked in.
Fruit of the Loom is the more interesting case. They have no workwear heritage. They're a basics brand. T-shirts, underwear, sweats. For them to release a fluorescent green pullover is a pure market signal. They've identified demand for these colors among general consumers, and they're filling it.
And they can do it cheap. Fruit of the Loom's entire infrastructure is built around high-volume, low-cost production. They're not trying to compete with Carhartt on durability. They're saying, you want the color, here's the color, $12.
Dickies is another one worth looking at. They've been pushing workwear-inspired streetwear for years. They've done collaborations with Vans, with Supreme. Dickies pants were a skateboarding staple long before the fashion industry noticed. The brand sits right on that boundary, authentic workwear that got adopted by subcultures, and then the company leaned into it.
The skateboarding to fashion pipeline is well established. Vans themselves went through it. Dickies just happened to be the pants everyone was wearing while it happened.
And they've been smart about it. They haven't abandoned their core workwear customer. The collaborations are limited runs, they generate buzz, and they bring new customers into the brand who might eventually buy the regular work pants too.
Patagonia is a different angle on this. They're not doing Hy-Vees, but their whole model is built around durability and repairability. The ironclad guarantee. They'll repair or replace anything, basically forever. That's the sustainability argument Daniel is making, applied to outdoor gear rather than safety wear.
Patagonia's repair program is genuinely impressive. They've dedicated repair centers. They'll teach you how to fix your own gear. They sell used Patagonia through their worn wear program. It's the antithesis of fast fashion. And it proves there's a market for durability. People will pay more for something that lasts.
The question is whether that model scales beyond the outdoor enthusiast demographic. Patagonia's customer is someone who already values durability and is willing to pay for it. The fast fashion customer is buying on price and trend cycle. Those are different planets.
Uniqlo is interesting here because they're trying to bridge that gap. Their workwear-inspired line uses stretch denim and reinforced stitching, but at a much lower price point than Patagonia or Carhartt. It's not ANSI-compliant high-vis, but it's applying workwear construction principles to mass-market fashion.
So the spectrum runs from actual certified safety gear on one end to clothing that borrows the look on the other. And Daniel's argument, if I'm reading him right, is that the whole spectrum is good, that even the aesthetic borrowing normalizes the colors and makes the real safety gear less conspicuous.
I think that's right, with one caveat. The normalization only works if the distinction remains legible. If someone buys a fluorescent jacket thinking it's safety gear and it's not, because it lacks the retroreflective tape or the right fabric area, that's a liability problem. Not just for the consumer, but potentially for the brand.
And some jurisdictions are already moving on this. The UK and Australia are considering labeling requirements for what they're calling fashion high-vis, to distinguish it from certified safety wear. If you sell something that looks like a safety vest but isn't, you might need to say so explicitly.
That's a knock-on effect I hadn't considered. If the fashion adoption triggers regulatory pushback, it could actually make real high-vis more expensive and harder to get. The certification costs get passed on, the testing requirements get stricter, and the gap between real and fashion widens.
Or it could go the other way. If consumers start demanding ANSI compliance in their everyday jackets, because they've experienced the utility of being visible on a dark road, brands might raise quality standards across the board to meet that demand.
The optimistic scenario is that the workwearification of fashion drags the whole industry toward durability. The pessimistic scenario is that it just creates a new category of disposable safety-inspired fast fashion, and the real safety gear gets more expensive and harder to find.
Let's talk about the material suppliers, because they're a part of this that doesn't get enough attention. 3M. They make Scotchlite reflective material and Thinsulate insulation. They're not a clothing brand, but they're actively partnering with fashion brands to integrate reflective materials into non-workwear designs.
Scotchlite is the interesting one. It's the same retroreflective technology used in safety vests, but 3M has been working with streetwear and athletic brands to incorporate it into sneakers, jackets, accessories. The material is the same. The application is different.
So the reflective strip on a Nike running jacket might be the exact same Scotchlite tape that's on a roadworker's vest. The jacket isn't ANSI certified because the overall design doesn't meet the standard, but the reflective element is genuine.
And that's the nuance that gets lost in the appropriation debate. It's not always fake. Sometimes it's real safety materials applied in non-certified configurations. The function is partially there.
The high-vis button-up Daniel bought is a good example. It has reflective stripes. But does it meet Class 2? Probably not. The tape placement might not be right. The background material area might be insufficient. But it's more visible than a regular shirt. It's on the spectrum.
There's a company called Safety Fashion, that's their actual name, that makes ANSI-compliant streetwear. Hoodies, jackets, vests that meet the standard but don't look like traditional work gear. They're explicitly targeting the crossover market Daniel is describing.
Safety Fashion. That's a name that knows exactly what it's doing.
They're small, but they're proving the concept. You can make clothing that's safety compliant and also something people want to wear voluntarily. It doesn't have to be the boxy neon vest that screams, "I'm doing a job."
I want to circle back to something Daniel said in his prompt. He mentioned buying things as a gag and then unexpectedly really liking them. I think that's actually a significant consumer behavior pattern that the industry is starting to recognize.
The ironic purchase that becomes unironic.
You buy the fluorescent orange shirt because it's funny. You wear it once as a bit, and then you realize this is actually comfortable, it's well made, and there's something useful about being visible. The joke wears off, and the utility remains.
And that's the conversion path. The brands don't need to convince people to buy high-vis for safety reasons. They just need to get the shirt on someone's back for any reason. The product does the rest.
Daniel walking around his house in a fluorescent orange Carhartt shirt at 3 p.m., then switching to a fluorescent yellow button-up in the evening. That's the conversion happening in real time. He started with curiosity, moved to amusement, and landed on genuine appreciation.
The question is, how many consumers follow that same path? Is Daniel an outlier, or is he an early indicator?
The Fruit of the Loom data point suggests he's not alone. Basics, brands don't add fluorescent SKUs unless they're seeing demand signals. Fruit of the Loom isn't a trend-chasing brand. They're a volume brand. They move when the numbers justify it.
And the numbers on the workwear side are growing. The 6.5% CAGR one mentioned, that's the safety market, but the fashion crossover isn't captured in those figures. It's a separate revenue stream that's harder to measure because it's scattered across so many categories.
All right, so let's pull on the sustainability thread harder, because Daniel specifically connected this to fast fashion being unsustainable. The argument is that workwear-grade durability, if it spreads to mainstream clothing, reduces the replacement cycle. Fewer garments produced, fewer in landfills.
The math is compelling. If a Carhartt jacket lasts 10 years and a fast fashion equivalent lasts 1, you've eliminated 9 replacement purchases. Multiply that across millions of consumers and the environmental impact is real. Water usage, carbon emissions, textile waste, all of it drops.
The counterargument is that most people don't want to wear the same jacket for 10 years. Fashion cycles are shorter than durability cycles. The jacket might be physically fine, but the consumer has moved on.
That's the behavioral challenge. Durability only matters if people actually keep wearing the thing. Patagonia's approach addresses this. They make timeless designs that don't look dated after 3 years. But that's harder to do at scale, and it requires a brand identity built around longevity rather than novelty.
Carhartt has that identity by accident. Their designs haven't changed much because their core customer doesn't want them to change. The fashion adoption is happening around them, not because they redesigned for it.
Dickies is in a similar position. The pants that skaters adopted in the 90s were the same pants mechanics were wearing. The product didn't change. The context did.
Which brings us to the question of whether this trend actually moves the needle on sustainability, or whether it's just a new aesthetic category that happens to use words like durable and workwear in the marketing.
I think the answer depends on which end of the spectrum we're talking about. The Carhartt core line and Patagonia. Those are durable products that reduce replacement cycles. The fast fashion fluorescent pullover from a brand with no durability heritage. That's probably ending up in a landfill at the same rate as everything else. It's just landfill that happens to be fluorescent green.
So the sustainability benefit is concentrated in the brands that were already making durable clothing. The new entrants are mostly just borrowing the color palette.
Which doesn't mean it's worthless. Even the color borrowing has the normalization effect Daniel is talking about. It makes Hy-Vees less alien, less purely industrial. That has value. It's just not primarily an environmental value.
The ideal outcome, and I think this is what Daniel is pointing toward, is that the normalization of the colors leads consumers to discover the durability of the real thing. You buy the cheap fluorescent pullover because it's interesting. You like being visible. And then you eventually upgrade to something that's actually built to last.
The gateway drug theory of Hy-Vee adoption.
I'm serious. The conversion path is real. Daniel is living it. He started with curiosity, bought the shirts partly as a gag, and now he's making arguments about sustainability and market trends. That's a journey.
No, I agree. The question is whether the journey is common enough to shift industry behavior. One guy in Jerusalem buying fluorescent button-ups is an anecdote. A million people doing, it's a market.
We won't know for a few years, but the brand activity suggests someone thinks the million-person scenario is plausible.
Let me add one more dimension to this. You mentioned earlier that I'd speculated about future ANSI revisions closing the loophole that allows high-vis button-ups and cargo shorts. I've been thinking about that more, and I'm not sure it'll happen. The trend is toward more flexibility and safety wear, not less. Workers want clothing that functions on and off the job site. Regulators tend to follow industry practice, not lead it.
So the button-up might become the standard rather than the exception.
Possibly. If enough workers are wearing Hy-Vees button-ups and the safety outcomes are equivalent, the standards will adapt. The current ANSI classes were designed around vests and jackets because that's what existed. If the market produces a button-up that performs just as well, the standard should accommodate it.
That's the optimistic regulatory scenario. The pessimistic one is what we mentioned earlier. A two-tier system where certified gear gets more expensive and fashion knockoffs flood the market, confusing everyone.
I think both things will happen simultaneously. The high end gets better and more expensive. The low end gets more colorful and disposable. The middle, which is where most workers actually buy their gear, gets squeezed.
You said yesterday that the middle of the workwear market is disappearing. This trend might accelerate that.
It might. The heritage brands go upmarket with whip lines and collaborations. the basics brands go down market with cheap fluorescent pullovers. The company that was making decent, affordable safety vests for contractors, where do they fit?
They don't. They get acquired or they close.
Which would be a loss, because that middle tier is where a lot of actual workers get their gear. If the choice becomes a $200 Carhartt WIP jacket or a $12 Fruit of the Loom pullover with no safety certification, the worker who needs real protection at a reasonable price is in trouble.
That's the structural risk underneath the fun trend. The fashion adoption might actually make things worse for the people who need this clothing for safety, not better.
Unless the fashion adoption drives enough volume that the middle tier can survive on scale. If millions of people are buying high-vis adjacent clothing, the cost of producing the real stuff might come down enough to keep the middle viable.
The economies of scale argument. It's possible. The dye lots get cheaper. The reflective tape manufacturing gets more efficient. The supply chain optimizes around higher volume. But that only helps if the middle-tier brands can access those supply chains at competitive prices.
And if they can differentiate themselves from the fast fashion knockoffs. If a consumer can't tell the difference between a certified safety vest and a fashion vest that's the same color, the middle tier brand has to spend more on marketing and labeling to communicate the distinction. That's a cost the fast fashion brands don't have to bear.
All right. I think we need a perspective from someone who's actually lived in Hevies.
I wore it 12 hours a day for a summer and I hated every minute of it. 1998. Road flagger for a construction outfit outside Hartford. They issued me 5 high-vis vests, 5 pairs of orange pants, and a hard hat. I looked like a human caution cone. I used to dream about wearing a black t-shirt. Just a plain black t-shirt. That was the fantasy. So when I tell you I bought a high-vis hoodie last month, understand what that means. I never thought I'd voluntarily put on fluorescent anything again, but it's actually useful. I wear it on my evening walks. I don't have to carry a flashlight. I just exist, and cars see me. My wife bought me one of those Fruit of the Loom fluorescent green polos. I wear it to the grocery store.
You, of all people, voluntarily wearing high-vis.
The hoodie's from a company called Safety Fashion. It's ANSI compliant. It doesn't look like road crew gear. It looks like a hoodie that happens to be bright. That's the difference. 28 years ago, the only option was the boxy vest with the reflective X across the chest. Now there's a hoodie.
What made you buy it?
I walk the dog at night. The street we live on has no sidewalk, and the neighbors drive too fast. I got tired of jumping into bushes. The hoodie solved the problem. No bushes required. The thing I still have, the thing that's actually relevant to what you two are talking about, is my old flagger vest, the one with the pocket for the stop slow paddle. I use it as a gardening apron now. It's the most durable piece of clothing I own. 28 years old. The reflective tape is peeling, but the fabric is indestructible.
28 years.
The fabric doesn't care. It's been through construction sites, road work, 3 moves, and now it's covered in potting soil. Still holds together. That's what the sustainability argument is actually about. Not whether the color is fashionable. Whether the thing survives.
That's exactly the point. The vest was built to a standard that fast fashion doesn't even attempt, and it's still functional after nearly 3 decades.
The new hoodie won't last 28 years. It's well made, but it's not that. But it'll last longer than the $12 pullover. And I'll actually wear it, which I wouldn't do with a construction vest, so the net durability is probably higher. The thing you two didn't mention, the real reason Fruit of the Loom is selling fluorescent green, is that one of their fabric buyers overordered on a dye lot for a safety vest contract about 3 years ago. They had the material. They had to do something with it, so they ran a test batch of pullovers, sold through in 2 weeks, and now it's a permanent SKU.
It was a supply chain accident.
Most of this stuff is. Someone overorders, someone runs a test, the test sells, and suddenly it's a trend. The brand strategy narrative you two built is nice, but the actual origin story is usually one person in a meeting saying, "We've got 40,000 yards of this fabric, what do we do with it?"
That's honestly more believable than the strategic vision we were constructing.
It's always more believable. I worked in procurement for 3 years after the flagger job. You'd be amazed how many product lines start with a warehouse full of something nobody ordered on purpose.
So the movement toward durable, sustainable workwear fashion crossover is partly a movement and partly an inventory problem.
It's a movement now. It wasn't a movement when it started. It was a clearance strategy that accidentally proved there was demand. Now the brands are being intentional about it. But the origin is dumber than anyone wants to admit. The flag arrest is still in my shed. I'm not getting rid of it. The day it finally falls apart, I'll probably frame it.
Where does this leave us?
I think Daniel's right that the crossover is a net positive. The normalization of high VA colors makes safety-adjacent clothing more accessible. The durability argument is real, at least for the brands that were already making durable clothing. And the conversion path from ironic purchase to genuine appreciation is something the market is starting to recognize.
The open question is whether this leads to better clothing for everyone, or just a new category of disposable safety-inspired fast fashion. I think we get both. The high end gets more functional and more fashionable. The low end gets more fluorescent and just as disposable as ever. The middle, where most workers actually shop, might disappear.
If the middle disappears, the people who need this clothing for safety, not fashion, are the ones who lose. That's the structural risk underneath the fun trend.
Daniel, you're not alone in your high-vis journey. I think you're onto something. Wear that orange shirt with pride. And if anyone asks, tell them it's not a gag. It's a statement. About durability, visibility, and the fact that life is too short not to own a fluorescent button-up.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently still has work clothes older than most of our listeners.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.